content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. Today, we're starting with an article from the history section called Sweet Dreams, and it's by Eric Medlin. On July 2nd, North Carolina's Republican-controlled legislature announced that it had finally passed its first budget in 3 years, making it the last state in the nation to do so. For months, no one in the legislature, not even members of the same party, seemed capable of finding common ground. State House and Senate leaders bickered over specific funding priorities such as a children's hospital in Apex and the scope of government job cuts. The wait was both painful for state employees and a testament to the widespread feeling that government simply does not work for anyone anymore. But there was a time when the state's legislators, no matter how ideologically opposed, did work together. They passed large spending programs and found ways to bridge at least some of the gaps between liberals and conservatives on major controversies. It likely helped that for almost half of the 20th century, many of them stayed in the same Raleigh hotel. The Sir Walter Hotel in downtown Raleigh was the epicenter of North Carolina politics for over 4 decades. It not only hosted important political speeches, campaign events and lobbying meetings from the 1920s through the 1970s, but it was also the site of countless secret backroom deals. If you were a legislator who wanted to gerrymander a district, for instance, you knew where to go. Everybody understood Phil Carlton, former state Supreme Court justice and longtime political operative, said recently. Everybody understood that laws got made at night around a poker table in someone's room at the Sir Walter. This was just an accepted way to do it. The Third House of Government. In the 1920s, Raleigh's civic boosters, including the News and Observer editor and publisher Josephus Daniels, had a problem. Most business convention traffic flowed to larger cities like Greensboro and Durham rather than staying in the capital, which was then only the fifth largest city in the state. Their proposed solution, a brand new skyscraper hotel, complete with private baths and telephones that would attract business travelers and a host of a wide variety of events. Completed in 1924 for roughly $900,000, the Sir Walter, as it was known, featured arched window openings, egg and dart moulding, and a three-part structure with a base, middle, and ornate cap like a Greek column. Later, it would become the first North Carolina hotel to have central air conditioning. Sitting 10 stories high at 400 to 412 Fayetteville Street, the Sir Walter Raleigh was only 3 blocks from the state capitol. Within a few months, the hotel had become the unofficial headquarters of the legislature, housing up to 80% of lawmakers during legislative sessions. They lived, ate meals together, and held daily meetings in its conference rooms. By 1957, U.S. Senator Sam Ervin Jr. was calling the Sir Walter the most politically saturated inn in America. That much concentrated political power was bound to attract lobbyists, which the Sir Walter did in great numbers. In room 215, politicos helped themselves to the steady supply of alcohol provided by the state's liquor lobby, which remained a haven for parties until 1957, when a News and Observer expose led to the seizure of 9 cases of liquor. Other lobbyist rooms, such as one for trucking organizations in the early 1960s, became the new sources for legislators looking for a drink. With liquor flowing freely to powerful men, many of whom were living hours away from their wives, prostitution flourished. The authorities often ignored it, but for a brief window during the Second World War, they decided to crack down. On August 19, 1942, a Mrs. C.F. Wirtz was sentenced to 8 months in prison for using a hotel for immoral purposes. Perhaps the most dramatic moment in the history of the Sir Walter came during the 1950 U.S. Senate primary, when Willis Smith ran against Frank Porter Graham to be North Carolina's Democratic Party nominee that year. Graham was repeatedly spat on across the state. Smith's forces mercilessly attacked Graham, the incumbent, and a former University of North Carolina Chapel Hill president, as a communist for his opposition to Jim Crow and his belief in economic equality. The vitriol extended to campaign workers as well, with one Graham worker imploring the candidate to come and take all your literature out of my house. My neighbours won't talk to me. It was one of the most contentious races in the state's history, with one side embracing civil rights and modernity, while the other clung to segregation and the past. Yet, no matter how wide the ideological gulf was between Graham and Smith, the physical distance between them was next to zero. Both campaigns were headquartered at the Sir Walter, with Graham on the sixth floor and Smith on the first. Every day, opposing staff passed each other in the hallways and ate in the same dining room. On the night of the primary runoff, June 24, 1950, which Smith narrowly won, Graham was forced to walk by his opponent and shake his hand as he left. His dejected supporters had to sneak by Smith's whooping advocates. The hotel remained busy even outside of election night or the legislative session. If you came to Raleigh, you just stayed at the Sir Walter. Tom Lambeth, a former aide to Terry Sanford and a long-time Democratic political adviser, recalled. During the 1960 presidential campaign, when John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson vied for the Democratic nomination, both candidates and eager Kennedy surrogate Harry S. Truman stayed at the Sir Walter. Lambeth often heard stories of tense meetings in the lobby and flirtatious dalliances in the dining room. It was no wonder that the hotel was often referred to as the third house of government. But the state's black citizens couldn't access their representatives at the Sir Walter, which was segregated. In 1963, civil rights protesters staged a check-in, a sit-in in the lobby with suitcases. Sanford, who was one of the few governors who did not base his campaign out of the hotel, responded by meeting with the protesters and listening to their demands. According to Carlton, Sanford and other liberals worked out of the nearby Carolina Hotel in order to avoid confrontations like the one during the Graham-Smith race. While not immediately successful in its goal of desegregating the hotel, the Sir Walter protests shone extra light on racial discrimination across Raleigh. The end of an era. By then, the Sir Walter's stature as a political hub had started to wane. The North Carolina Legislative Building, which featured much larger meeting and conference rooms, opened in 1963. As more people moved to the post-World War II suburbs and travelled the interstates, centralised downtowns, including Raleigh's, declined nationwide. Without steady bookings and revenue, the hotel was harder to maintain. More important, perhaps, was another factor. The Vietnam War, multiple shocking political assassinations, the explosive Democratic Convention of 1968, and the Watergate scandal shattered the public's trust in its leaders. Backroom dealings were no longer tolerated, at least not openly. The new generation of politicians who promoted fair primaries and political transparency diminished the strength of old-fashioned power brokers. The Sheraton Hotel chain took over the Sir Walter in 1968 and tried unsuccessfully to revive its reputation. Blanche Manor, who wrote a gossip column for the News and Observer, lived there for a time, greeting guests and attending social events into her 90s. The hotel changed ownership multiple times after that, but the efforts to attract business eventually fizzled out. Finally, in 1978, the building was converted into affordable housing units for seniors. It was added to the National Register of Historic Places that same year. Some state leaders shifted their operations to the Raleigh Hilton Inn on Hillsborough Street. Others went to the Governor's Inn in the Research Triangle Park. Neither of these places worked as well as in the heyday of the Sir Walter, which benefited from both its elegance and its proximity. Today, Raleigh's oldest surviving hotel building continues to evolve. In 2019, the Capital Realty Group, a New York firm, purchased the Sir Walter for almost $17 million and began renovations in the basement. Maintenance workers soon discovered what appeared to be a Prohibition-era speakeasy. When Anthony Rapillo, a local restaurateur, heard about that, he committed himself to reviving it as an underground cocktail bar, which he plans to call the Third House by the end of 2026. They had their normal meetings upstairs, but I am sure this is where many of the secret deals were made, Rapillo said of the building's political past. After years of navigating zoning requirements and specialty repairs, he is excited to bring what will likely be his 10th hospitality space in North Carolina to the century-old hotel. While that's good news for the Sir Walter, there is no longer any single hotel headquarters for either Democrats or Republicans in North Carolina. The past five governors have used four different locations for their victory parties, with Roy Cooper recently opting for a convention center at NC State and Josh Stein choosing Marriott City Center. With state politics as divided as ever, it's hard to remember the days when politicians came together, if for no other reason than to indulge in the same overnight vices. Now we have a change of pace. This is kind of a mixture of politics and environment. Blowing off balloons, an article by Corinne Sanders. Kristin Martin of Killdevil Hills was fed up when she spotted several Mylar Happy Birthday balloons wrapped around a power line by her next-door neighbour's house this spring. It's arcing when it hits the live line. These things are conduits for electricity. We're in a dry spell and the lot behind is completely wooded, Martin wrote in the caption of a video she posted on Facebook. For the love of all that is sacred, please stop releasing balloons. Martin didn't know where the balloons originated. Both Killdevil Hills and Dare County have banned people from intentionally releasing them. She's part of a group advocating for the state to do the same, arguing that in addition to posing a fire hazard, balloons threaten coastal wildlife. Other East Coast states, including Virginia and Florida, have already enacted such laws. Louisiana also passed a ban that takes effect next month. But in North Carolina, legislation has sunk in committee in both the state House and Senate. It's such a common sense, easily solvable issue, said Debbie Swick, a resident of Southern Shores who is advocating for a statewide ban and runs a related Facebook group. The low-hanging fruit, pick it off, get it done and move on. Releasing big floating bouquets as part of a wedding, graduation or funeral ceremonies may appeal to a certain Instagram aesthetic, but balloons have been documented travelling hundreds of miles. Balloons that an Iowa family released as part of a birthday celebration in 2023 were found in New York the next day, 932 miles away. A science project in 2016 documented a balloon travelling 972 miles from Texas to Ohio. In December 2023, Swick found a balloon on the beach near Jeanette's Pier in Nag's Head that had travelled more than 700 miles from a large real estate company in Birmingham, Alabama, she previously told Outer Banks Insider. She figured out its origin from the company logo printed above the words Happy Holidays. Swick called their office, wasn't satisfied with the response, and then called the CEO directly. He vowed to not provide balloons for his realtors anymore in Alabama, she said. In Emerald Isle in 2023, a Gervais beaked whale calf died after ingesting a Mylar balloon, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Both Cape Hatteras National Seashore and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have publicized information about the deadly dangers the debris pose to wildlife that ingest it or become entangled. State Senator Bobby Hannig, a Currituck County Republican, introduced a bill with two Democratic co-sponsors named Prohibiting Certain Mass Balloon Releases in January 2025, which would set a statewide fine of $250 for unleashing inflatables. It was referred to the Senate's Committee on Rules and Operations the next day, and it hasn't moved since. "We are allowing litter," Hannig told the Assembly. "What comes up comes down, you know. It kills all types of species of animals, whether they're in the water or on the land. It's just common sense." Floating regulations. Topsail and Surf City passed balloon ban ordinances in 2023, and similar restrictions were already in place in Jacksonville, Swansboro, and Wrightsville Beach. Because of SWCC's advocacy, Currituck and Dare counties and all six municipalities in Dare County adopted bans on intentional outdoor releases between April 2024 and February 2025. Fines range from $25 to $250. State Representative Pricey Harrison, a Guilford County Democrat, said she attended a plastic symposium in eastern North Carolina in fall 2023, where the local efforts inspired her to propose her own statewide legislation the following year. She noted how balloons released inland can blow to the coast and can affect waterways closer to home in the Piedmont. "People just need to understand how dangerous it is and problematic for wildlife," Harrison said. "It's just really heartbreaking to see it killing whales and dolphins." Her Marine Life Protection Act called for warnings for first-time offenders, a fine of no more than $200 on a second offence, then no more than a $500 fine for subsequent offences. It also included a $100,000 appropriation to the Department of Environmental Quality for educational activities related to the prohibition imposed by this act. It was referred to the Committee on Appropriations, where nothing has happened. Harrison says her bill faced two strong headwinds: politics and timing. Only one Republican, Representative Bill Ward of Pasquotank County, joined the 17 Democratic co-sponsors. "It's hard for a mostly Democratic-sponsored bill to get a hearing," Harrison said, and she didn't have much time in the short session to recruit more support. Ward said in a phone call that he worked as a police officer on the Outer Banks for 9 years. He recalled seeing balloons miles from land when he fished offshore. "I saw remnants of balloons, actually close to the Gulf Stream, where they would, you know, deflate and land, and then the tides would carry them," Ward said. House Speaker Destin Hall, a Caldwell County Republican, did not respond to requests for comment, nor did the four senior chairs of the Appropriations Committee. Mecklenburg County Democratic State Representative Mary Belk, a co-sponsor of Harrison's bill, believes a perceived effect on tourism might have helped stall it. "I think it may have a problem, similar to the coastal county plastic bag ban that was eliminated some years ago," Belk wrote in an email. "If something is perceived as working against the tourism industry, it is viewed with extreme skepticism by the current NCGA leadership, which I find ironic, because who wants to get wrapped up in a balloon string on the beach?" Scott Peacock, a spokesman for the State Tourism Board, declined to comment, saying the group doesn't weigh in on policy issues. Outer Banks Visitors Bureau Executive Director Lee Nettles said he doesn't believe his board has taken any formal action related to either local or proposed state balloon release bans, but our board's supportive of any action that keeps litter out of the ocean. Won't let it blow over. Hannig, meanwhile, says he's unaware of any opposition to the bill he filed in the state Senate last year. "The difficulty is that nobody opposes it," Hannig said. "Nobody. From the manufacturers to the retailers to the distributors, nobody opposes the bill at all." He said he believes Senator Bill Rabin, a Brunswick County Republican who chairs the rules panel, has prevented it from moving out of his committee, though Hannig didn't know why. "He's been the hold-up on it," Hannig told the Assembly in June. "I can't get an explanation." Rabun declined to comment when a reporter asked him about it in the legislature. He referred the reporter to Senate leader Phil Berger's communications director, Lauren Horsch, who did not respond to emailed questions. Swick, the Southern Shores resident, said it doesn't make sense to her that Rabun, a veterinarian by trade, would not be enthusiastic about a bill to protect animals. She said he has not responded to her repeated efforts to contact him by phone or email. "I would think a veterinarian would have been like pushing his way to the front of the line and going, 'I hate balloons,'" Swick said. Hannig said he would keep advocating for a ban, though he'll have to do it from outside the legislature after this year. He didn't seek re-election to the state Senate, but instead ran for a U.S. House seat and lost in the primary. Ward and Harrison also said they would keep pushing. "I'm thinking we're going to bring it back," Ward said. "More and more communities are passing these bans in North Carolina, so I think the momentum is growing," Harrison said. "So I think we'll be able to maybe make more progress next year." The final article today is an update on an article which we covered a few months ago. It's in the energy section, and it's Durham Energy Company accused of fraud files for bankruptcy. And the writer of the article is Lisa Sorg. American Efficient, a Durham-based energy efficiency business facing more than $1 billion in federal fines and repayments for allegedly manipulating electricity markets, has filed for bankruptcy protection, court filings show. The filing comes 3 months after the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission unanimously ruled that the company withheld key information from and defrauded electric grid operators, including PJM Interconnection. PJM is the regional transmission organization that manages wholesale electricity markets in Washington, D.C. and all or parts of 13 states, including northeastern North Carolina. FERC fined the company $722 million and ordered it to repay more than $410 million in unjust profits to electric grid operators. "I don't vote likely for disgorgement and civil penalties this high," said FERC Commissioner Lindsay See, a Republican and Biden appointee, at a public meeting in April. "But we've not been faced with a scam that robbed ratepayers of hundreds of millions of dollars in this way before." American Efficient has long denied the allegations. Last year, the company called FERC's accusations baseless and a consequence of bad math and a misreading of the agreements the company had with grid operators. After FERC's ruling in April, an American Efficient spokesperson said the company stands by its position that the commission's allegations are meritless and that it did not commit any wrongdoing. Ben Abram, American Efficient managing director, declined to comment on the bankruptcy. Abram graduated from Duke University and later served on its board of trustees. He is married to State Senator Sophia Chitlick, who represents parts of Durham County. The News and Observer recently report that they are legally separated. American Efficient filed for a Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization. The company has assets worth $1 million to $10 million, according to bankruptcy filings, and liabilities of $1.4 billion. In addition to the FERC penalty, the company owes $3.2 million in taxes to four states, including North Carolina. FERC's investigation into American Efficient began 5 years ago after independent market monitors became skeptical of the company's business model and alerted the commission's enforcement staff. American Efficient operated as an energy efficiency aggregator. It bought sales data about certain items environmental attributes, the inherent characteristics of light bulbs, appliances, caulk, and other products that make them energy efficient, from large retailers like Lowe's, The Home Depot, and Walmart, as well as lighting manufacturers and distributors. Once it had the retailer's sales data on the number of units sold, American Efficient then calculated how much electricity those products were expected to save. The company profited when it sold the value of the projected savings to grid operators at capacity auctions. At these auctions, the grid operator pays a power supplier, such as a utility, or an energy efficiency resource, such as American Efficient, for its ability to produce or save power to ensure the reliability of the electric grid in the future. These costs are ultimately passed on to ratepayers through their respective utilities. Over more than a decade, grid operators paid American Efficient hundreds of millions of dollars on the theory that encouraging energy efficiency reduces the amount of power they must procure. For example, American Efficient received a $26 million performance bonus for purportedly saving energy during the Winter Storm Elliott in 2022. The payments to the retail stores were designed to encourage the sale and use of energy-efficient products, thereby saving electricity and theoretically reducing air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. But in investigatory documents, FERC alleged that American Efficient's business model did not save energy, but was merely market research. The company's payments to the retailers were as little as 12 cents per refrigerator and even less per light bulb. FERC investigators said there was no evidence these micropayments, as American Efficient called them, incentivized the stores to promote the energy-efficient products to their customers. The company didn't verify how the stores were spending the micropayments according to the FERC files or track whether consumers who bought the appliances or light bulbs actually saved energy. The investigation quoted testimony by a former policy director at one of American Efficient's affiliated companies who told FERC staff that American Efficient did not believe it was causing energy efficiency to occur or that it did. The employee is not named in the document. The company disputed the former policy director's accounts and in court documents called her a disgruntled employee. Beyond the bankruptcy filing, American Efficient can still argue the FERC case before a judge and jury. Since the company will likely miss the payment deadline, FERC will proceed to federal district court, which could hear new evidence and arguments. If American Efficient prevails at trial, the court could cancel the fine or both sides could reach a settlement. 40% of FERC investigations that carry a proposed penalty result in a settlement or reduced fines, federal records show. Neither side has filed for a new trial, according to the federal court docketing system. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. If you have any requests for in-depth North Carolina reporting, please call 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening.